You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
For all its difficulties, life expectancy in Africa has risen astonishingly as that country has entered the global economic system.
Boris Johnson returns to Africa, but this time he's being asked the questions, or thanks to the intervention of his Foreign Office minders, not. My guests Samira Shackle and John Everard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including North Korea's attempt to extradite a corpse from Malaysia, India's record-breaking satellite launch, and the ringtone that launched a million fantasies of swift and violent revenge by enraged commuters. Is the Nokia 3310 about to make a comeback? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist Samira Shackle and John Everard, formerly the UK's ambassador to North Korea. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with the peculiar diplomatic standoff now pitting Malaysia against North Korea, following yesterday's apparent assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, in Kuala Lumpur Airport. Pyongyang has requested the delivery of his body. Malaysia, as we go to air, is declining to cooperate. In a further development, Malaysia authorities have made one arrest of a woman who was reportedly carrying a Vietnamese passport. John, as our many obsessive round-the-clock listeners will know, we discussed this story last night on The Daily. What have we learned in the intervening 20 hours?
The big change is that we know now that there were more people involved than we thought. It wasn't just two women, it was two women and four men. The two women applied the poison, whether through a cloth or just by splashing it, and the four men were the lookouts. We have still got unanswered the question of why, if the woman they've arrested is indeed a North Korean intelligence operative, why is she still alive? North Korean agents are not taken alive. They take their suicide pills and they do not talk, but there she's still there. Also, it's curious that she went back to the airport. Lots of stories coming out of Malaysia that for some reason she was abandoned by the other five in her group. Now, this is not the normal way that North Korean hit squads operate. They stick tightly together because they know that if one of their number is captured, they are all in trouble. So lots and lots of question marks. We may get a couple of answers in the next few hours because the Malaysians have got their top forensic scientists working on Kim Jong-nam's body, and they were trying to get an autopsy report out late today, Malaysian time. It may drift in tomorrow, but the wait shouldn't be too long.
Just one follow-up question, John. Do you interpret the demand for the body from Pyongyang as basically a claim of responsibility?
No. Regardless of how he died, regardless of who killed him, he is a member of the royal family, and it would be unthinkable for Pyongyang just to let him be buried wherever, in a local Malaysian cemetery. They will want to take him back and to bury him somewhere in sacred ground in Pyongyang.
Samira, Pyongyang, you would have to imagine, guessed or understood that Malaysia wouldn't sort of immediately say, yeah, fine, we'll put him on the next flight. What are they therefore hoping to gain by putting Malaysia on the defensive?
It's very odd, the whole case. I mean, it's quite hard to interpret what the motivation would be for that. And I mean, if indeed it was an assassination, as it appears to be, it's difficult to unpick what the motivation is. Obviously, apart from the fact that various analysts have said that Kim Jong-un didn't pose any sort of active threat to the leadership, but there's also the fact that, you know, there's huge potential for embarrassment, diplomatic spats, and so on. And so it's a very sort of murky. It's not clear. I don't think we'll be able to easily pick out motivation for any of those subsequent actions either.
John, I was reading Rodong Sinmun just before we came to air. The
poor person.
The always exciting newspaper of the Korean Workers' Party. It may not surprise you to learn that they're covering coverage of this affair has so far been muted, which is to say there isn't any. Is there likely to be?
It's possible there will be. There's no love lost between Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-nam. And when Jang Song-taek was executed in December 2013, it took them a few days, but they did actually come out with a short story telling the world that this abysmal man had in fact been removed from civilization. We may see a short story reporting the departure of Kim Jong-nam in the same kind of vein.
Samira, are we, do you think, embarked on one of those occasional periods in which we are compelled as a world to start worrying about North Korea again? I mean, it's always there, but every so often they get a little more cranky than usual. And this, of course, follows up last week's missile test.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because I think because the nature of the regime in North Korea and the way that the state functions is so extreme and so hermetic, there's a tendency, I think, in the media, certainly in the West, to see North Korea as quite a sort of humorous, funny, mad rogue state, and that, you know, you get lots of, apart from the sort of intermittent stories about nuclear missile tests or these horrendous human rights abuses in the interim, there's lots of kind of, oh, look, isn't this funny, look what this nutty state's doing, or look what this crazy leader's doing, and so on. There's a sort of caricature, and I think that there are sometimes reminders, whether that's from quite harrowing accounts from defectors or sort of international fracas like this or issues with nuclear missiles, that sort of make remind you that it's not necessarily particularly funny, and that it does need to be taken seriously.
This is all an extremely fair point, John, and I will hold my hands up and admit that I've certainly probably been guilty of it myself. But do we make a mistake in lapsing into viewing North Korea as a sort of quaint Ruritanian oddity?
Absolutely. North Korea is dangerous, very dangerous, and it has to be stopped. Over the last 72 hours, the killing of Kim Jong-nam is reprehensible and lamentable, but isn't actually a threat to anybody outside the North Korean elite. The missile test quite definitely was. They've demonstrated that they can launch a missile using solid fuel technology, so you don't have to stand the missile on launch site and fuel it, which means that the window to take a missile out on the launch pad is very, very short. And they used a tracked launch vehicle, which means you can fire these missiles from anywhere you like. You're not restricted to roads if you fire them from a forest in the middle of the mountains. It means that was their answer to Donald Trump, saying that the intercontinental missile hitting the United States was not going to happen. They've shown that they could make it happen if they want to. It's scary.
Okay, well, let's move along to things being launched skyward for slightly more benign purposes, specifically from India, which has set a world record, a not of this world record, if you will, by successfully deploying 104 small satellites from a single mission. This eclipses the previous record held by Russia of 37 in one whack. Significantly, 96 of those satellites are American-owned. The other foreign clients were Israel, the Netherlands, the United Arab Emirates, Switzerland, and Kazakhstan. Samira, this is one of those stories which you... I mean, how far back do you have to go before this would sound completely incomprehensible, the idea of American firms relying on Indian rockets to get their satellites into space? 20 years? 30 years? It is an extraordinary story. How did we get to this point?
It's really interesting. I mean, it's just that sort of the rate of change. And I know when I first read this story in my head, sort of space races and things like that are things that are from the Cold War era, as it were. And then suddenly thinking, hang on, this is a huge industry. And like most of those satellites were commercially based, and a huge amount of this, I think about half of it, was funded through sort of commercial funding, because there's American-owned satellites, most of them are owned by private companies and so on, and sort of thinking about the business interest of sending satellites into space, the kind of use for things like atmospheric research and checking the weather and surveillance, all these different sorts of things. It's just I think indicative of how quickly things are changing and how unfamiliar those industries of the future will be.
And just to follow that up, Samira, I mean, it is, as you point out, an extraordinarily profitable or increasingly profitable business for India. Is it profitable to the extent, or will it be profitable to the extent that it will defray that fairly common criticism that India still suffers from massive, extraordinary poverty, is a fairly large-scale recipient of foreign aid, and as such should possibly have more earthly priorities?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the argument, certainly, that the Indian state would make, I think, which is that, you know, things which are, you know, sort of furthering, first of all, that furthering scientific research and so on is an end in itself and a worthy thing to spend money on regardless of poverty. And secondly, that it will eventually, you know, if these industries will contribute to India as a rising economic power, that will affect the you know, sort of improve the country's dire poverty rates. I think it's a really interesting debate, because certainly I think all the kind of commercial space interests have been watching this satellite launch with interest, because India is providing these services at a much lower cost than America or Europe, as in many other industries that we've seen. But, you know, the fact remains that India's economy has grown massively in the last 10 years, and there hasn't been a huge improvement in those poverty rates. You know, I think it's something like 22% of the population live below the poverty line, 40% of children are malnourished. There's all sorts of indices on which India is doing really badly. And if you go there, it's plainly apparent there is abject poverty. And a lot of those benefits, while yes, there is a rising middle class and so on, but a lot of the time, as in many developing and non-developing countries around the world, the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying pretty stationary. And I don't know if you're, you know, one of the, I can't remember the exact percentage, it's, I think it's about 50% of the population who doesn't have access to a toilet. Maybe you're not that enthused about satellites going into space.
For all that, John, how important is the space program to India, not merely as a commercial and scientific enterprise, but as a symbol, and as a symbol of national pride and a demonstration of national ambition, the soft power aspect, if you will?
Very much so. I mean, can we just stay with the commercial aspect for a moment? I mean, essentially, if you want a satellite launch, there's only the country that can do it for you are Russia, China, France, and India. The United States doesn't really do this anymore. And India has shown that it can launch massively cheaper than anyone else, and it can do so at high technology. Launching 104 satellites off one launch took a great deal of very careful preparation. People didn't think they could do it, but it went like clockwork. And the commercial returned on this, you know, India making living, India making money to hopefully alleviate some of the poverty that Shamir has just reminded us of, are pretty good. But, of course, there's more to it than that. There's deep symbolism, and there's immense Indian pride invested in these programs. Remember that just as the launch went off, well, actually a couple of days before, India announced that it's going to send a probe to Venus. Nobody has really attempted this before, not on the scale that India foresees, and it was quite a thing to go for. Remember that after the humiliating failure of the Chinese Mars probe in 2012, India and the United States in 2014 both launched successful Mars probes, but the American probe cost $671 million, the Indian one cost $76. India has shown that it can conduct serious deep space research very cheaply.
This was a point Narendra Modi was not shy about making at the time, as I recall, that India can do this at a fraction of the cost elsewhere. Samira, for all those reservations we were talking about how desperately poor people would regard this extraordinary expensive program, how important would it be to people in India, a significant advance in the space program, like sending an orbiter to Venus or even manned missions? Would they be domestically popular?
Yeah, I'm sure. I think that the national pride is a huge thing. There's actually across South Asia a real interesting cultural obsession almost with breaking world records. It's something I've noticed in Pakistan and India and Bangladesh. It's quite universal. So people absolutely love when their country breaks world records, whether it's on something to do with space or, like, you know, victories in squash and international tournaments or whatever. It's very popular. And this is also a time when, you know, India it's sort of Indian political structures are really emphasizing national pride. You've got a Hindu nationalist in the sort of election elected with a huge majority in Narendra Modi, a sort of Hindu nationalist party at the helm. There's, you know, like all really, really, I think national pride is always a big thing in India, and shows of national pride are a big thing. But I think particularly at this moment, it really is on the ascendancy. And so I'm sure it will be very popular. And I think also all the reservations we were talking about earlier should be taken with a very strong caveat that those particular lines of arguments arouse understandably hugely strong emotions in India, I think, because there's the sense that, you know, that it's not fair to argue that just because poverty exists, they shouldn't also be accessing technology and research and knowledge and all of those things.
There has been, and I know this because I looked it up, one Indian in space. This was the cosmonaut Rakesh Sharma, who flew on Soyuz T-11 in 1984. There was also an Indian-born astronaut, Kalpana Chawla, who was killed in the Columbia shuttle disaster. Final thought on this, John. How significant could an India versus China space race be?
Could it be? I think it is. I mean, I think that is precisely what is going on. And if you read the comments on the various media analyses of this, there's a great deal of tee-hee, we're ahead of you, China, and watch out, Pakistan, going on. Quite clearly, in Indianized China is the one to beat. And today's launch shows that they can probably do it.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Muller, Samira Shackle and John Everard. Coming up, it had to happen. Boris Johnson makes his first visit to Africa as Foreign Secretary.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and John Everard. Now, the first visit to Africa as Foreign Secretary by Boris Johnson was always likely to be the cue for his former colleagues in the press corps to remind him of some of his previous remarks vis-a-vis the continent, and so it has proved. In The Gambia, local journalists seeking to exercise their recently acquired power to ask politicians questions were forcibly dissuaded by Johnson's minders. Samira, this has followed Boris Johnson around, or it's really two columns that have continued to follow him around. Possibly unfashionably, I have a measure of sympathy for him on this front. Is it really fair to keep pursuing somebody over two paragraphs out of a catalogue of millions and millions of written words, especially when those two paragraphs, whether you found them funny or not, were obviously written with humorous intent?
I don't know, because I don't think it is only those two paragraphs. I think those are the two that get quoted a lot because they're the most shocking. But he's made all sorts of comments in writing and spoken all the time that just sort of show a certain mindset. And actually, you know, I don't, whether he's joking or not, I do think that there is some, you know, words do matter, especially when it's a politician who's now the Foreign Secretary. I have to often pinch myself to remind myself he's the actual Foreign Secretary, using incredibly loaded terms like pickaninny, watermelon smiles, and beyond that, talking very fondly about colony sort of talking about, and it's not just that. I mean, last year in a speech, he talked about Africa as a country. So I think that actually it is fair to pull him up on this stuff, because it's not just an accidental slip up that he made. He does this all the time. And I don't think that that saying, oh, well, it was just a joke, is really acceptable at all, particularly for someone who's the foreign secretary.
you can keep saying it, Samira. You might make yourself believe it eventually. John, words do matter. This is true. And nobody knows that better than Boris Johnson, who does write wonderfully well. He was a very good columnist. He's written several excellent volumes of popular history. The particular Telegraph column which people keep beating him over the head with, the one in which he made a reference to the local people of Africa with, as yes, flag-waving piccaninnies and watermelon smiles, there was a context to that. He was actually making fun of Tony Blair. He was suggesting that that was how Tony Blair saw Africa. He was actually making fun of a political opponent. Should he be given a pass on the grounds that he's foreign secretary now, which is now his job, but at that point his job was to be a provocative, amusing columnist?
I think you can make the case for a pass on those grounds, particularly as what he described as Tony Blair's views on Africa uncomfortably may well have been accurate. Tony Blair probably did see parts of Africa in those ways, except that he was rather more careful about saying such things in public. I think, yes, you know, columnists say different things from foreign secretaries. If Boris Johnson at any point in this tour had said anything remotely like the words he used in his column, I think, you know, we'd have every right to jump up and down in him. Mercifully, he's been, I wouldn't say restrained, but rather less flamboyant in his use of language than he has been in the past. I think he said some very silly things, but I'm prepared to let bygones be bygones and hope he meant his way for the future.
Samira, is it just... He has essayed, I think he did he not, John, essay one slightly poor dad joke about the
Jammy Dodger. Yes.
Is that the problem, though, Samira? It is, he has a sense of humour, and he is or can be a funny man, but he has a sense of humour which works quite well in a particular context of the kind that you occupy when you're a columnist on The Telegraph and the editor of The Spectator. But when you actually are out travelling the world representing your country, and I emphasise your country, I remain an Australian citizen, as its chief diplomat, is that the problem, that his sense of humour just doesn't translate?
Well, I think it's two problems. First of all, I think it's completely disingenuous that you're both acting as if it's just that one paragraph that he was satirising Tony Blair's views. It just certainly isn't. I mean, there's the other column he wrote where he said the tragedy isn't that we colonised Africa, the tragedy is that we ever left.
I think that's
pretty difficult to defend. And it's not just that. There's so many others. We could be here all evening. So many others. I mean, and as Foreign Secretary, he described Africa as a country. I mean, that's just ignorant and stupid, whether it's a slip of the tongue or not. I mean, and even apart from the whole incredibly sort of charged arguments about that particular use of language and talking as Africa as a country instead of a continent, even if you're not familiar with that, which you might well not be, it's just wrong. It's just really, really wrong. You wouldn't talk about Asia as a country or Europe as a country, I would hope.
That is a recurring trope, and you're right. Yeah. People don't make that mistake about any other continent. There's actually a very good blog on African affairs called Africa is a Country. Again... If you do talk enough into microphones, as I well know, you will get your sentences jumbled up occasionally.
Yeah, but if you're giving a speech as Foreign Secretary, surveying your time as Foreign Secretary, I think that that's slightly different in a prepared speech that you're giving. And I also think that if you say on record in writing, the tragedy is not that we colonised Africa, the tragedy is that we ever left, I think that you can absolutely be pulled up on that. And he's never really apologised. I mean, he apologised for the Piccaninny's Watermelon Smiles column, but his exact phrasing was, I feel sad that people were offended. That's not an apology.
No, that is the classic non-apology apology.
It's really not an apology. And so I think it's absolutely fine for him to be pulled up on it. And if, you know, maybe you think that use of language was humorous or whatever, fine. Talking about colony in such glowing terms is something that I'm personally not comfortable with in a foreign secretary. And if I was a journalist in the Gambia or anywhere else in Africa, I certainly would not be comfortable with. And if I was a politician in any African country, frankly,
John, it has to be said that if that him saying that the tragedies that we left, I think, you know, as Andrew said, it's difficult to defend that as a broad statement. If you had to pick a country where that come closer to the truth, you might well go for the Gambia, where the colonial administration was remarkably forward-looking and actually tried very hard to develop the Gambian economy and was followed by the Jawara administration, which simply stagnated, and by Jammeh, who simply robbed the place.
Perhaps,
and
he, said was, it sent he wasn't a long, talking long back. About he wasn't talking about Gambia, and he was talking about the continent of Africa.
And as I said, if you're going to take a country, it would be probably the Gambia. I'm not so sure that all the Gambian journalists listening to him would have reacted in quite the way that you suggest.
Okay, well, finally tonight, you can almost certainly recall a train journey or film being ruined by the following sound. The song of the Nokia 3310, still the world's best-selling mobile phone despite having been discontinued in 2005. However, reports suggest that HMD Oy Global, a Finnish manufacturer which owns the rights to the Nokia brand, has reasoned that 126 million purchases can't have been wrong and is planning to relaunch the cheap, simple and vexingly indestructible handset. Samira, do you want one?
I've got quite attached to having internet and sort of photos on my phone, so maybe not. But I did love my 3310 when I had one. I think I was all of 16 or something. So, yeah, it's I could sort of see the nostalgia appeal. It's definitely nice looking back on the days when you could make it a whole day without having to recharge a phone. That's a strong appeal.
John, would this be a bit like insisting on driving a Model T Ford at this point?
Yes, I was about to say a bit like insisting on riding a penny farthing rather than a modern bicycle, but I think we're on the same page. Yeah. I think that there may be a retro market there. Perhaps there are people who are so attached to the way that mobile phones used to be before they got smart that they'll be able to sell a few. But this is just nostalgia, and I think nostalgia belongs in the past.
Do you think there is any... Because they're trying to sell this, Samira, as a cheap and, I assume... cheerful telephone, which obviously won't have the features of a modern smartphone. But is there any imaginable market at this point for a phone which is that basic?
They do sell phones that are that basic still, but they cost about £10, which is about a sixth of what this is going to cost. I mean, you can get basic phones. I know a couple of people who either maybe use them when they're traveling for work or something. If they're going somewhere, they don't want to take a fancy phone. Or I've got one friend who is objects to the whole idea of a smartphone, and so uses one of these phones and carries an A to Z, since you don't have access to maps. But yeah, so maybe people like that. I can't imagine it's a huge market, but it's definitely more expensive than the existing basic phones that are already on the market.
See, because this is what I assume they're going to try and do, John, is just advertise it as, you know, with the virtue of simplicity, that you can only make phone calls or receive text messages. Yeah. I mean, to which I'm tempted to respond, I'd be quite tempted by something similar on which you couldn't even do that. My ideal phone, I increasingly think, is just an inanimate plastic slab that doesn't actually have any ability to communicate at all.
Do you also ride a penny farthing?
Better still, prevents anybody from communicating with me is the real sort of sweet spot.
So what you really want is no phone at all.
Yeah, I was wanting to see this. So I'm asking about Nokia 3310s because I was such a late adopter. They'd already gone by the time I got my first mobile phone. I was the last person in London to get one. I mean, is there any kind of... Is there anything useful that you can do with this phone that you can't do with one of those £10 phones?
No, probably not. Probably not. Maybe it's a nicer interface. Some of those £10 ones aren't particularly user-friendly. I was going to say you can drop it loads and it won't break, but the £10 ones probably do the same.
Again, and I don't think it's waterproof. I mean, if you can drown with the 310, whereas some of the more modern ones, you can put drop in the sink and they come out okay.
Should they resist, John, the feature to add to the feature? I was going to say the feature to add temptation. Should they resist? You see how easy it is, Samira. You can just
Africa's a country.
Exactly, Africa's a country. But should they resist the temptation to try and jazz it up by trying to sneak a camera on there or some sort of limited internet access?
Yes, I think they should. I think if you're going to produce a retro phone, you do it completely retro. You do not upgrade it. You do not jazz it up. You sell to the market who still hanker after the simplicities of a Nokia 3310.
And Samira, you keep that enraging ringtone?
Yeah, maybe. I remember when they got even more annoying when the one step up when you could have the, was it polyphonic ones? Those were really annoying. It's like the same but with sort of chords.
I do remember that. That is how they should have advertised. It's like even more annoying. Samira and John, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. That is all we have time for. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, 1900. Daniel is back with The Entrepreneurs, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.